Ting versus Covington Water District. And I hope I pronounced that correctly.
If I could return, reserve 2 minutes, please.
2 minutes?
Yeah. If it pleases the court, my name is Brian Hannes. I am representing the petitioners in this matter. The facts in this case are fairly straightforward. We have a developer who came into the boundaries of Covington Water District, which is an exclusive boundaries granted by statutes to Covington Water District. He looked to develop his property, so he approached the district about doing those connections. As a part of that, it got to a point where he signed a system extension agreement. Under that SEA, he was required to pay incremental connection charges. Under the SEA, they were to be classified as, non-refundable incremental connection charge. The question that I present to the court is whether this non-refundable language is within the power or the purview of what is expected or what is allowed for a district when putting these conditions upon anybody who's wishing to connect to their water district.
So it's not the nature of the contract, which seems fairly clear, that is the problem. It's the power of the parties to the contract that you're focusing on.
Yeah, I mean, because my client obviously is a developer. He deemed to kind of know what he's signing, and he looked at that. He could have seen that language, but the problem is he has no right to negotiate that. If he wants water provided by the district.
If he thinks that that's either arbitrary and capricious or in excess of powers, isn't he able to seek declaratory relief in the court?
I guess he could have, and maybe he doesn't understand that process at that time. Unfortunately, I can't speak to what his mindset was when he signed that agreement.
Sometimes we think that when people sign agreements, they give up the opportunity to claim that they shouldn't have been required to sign that agreement. The time to do it is before you sign it, not afterwards. And not afterwards and when you fail to perform.
I agree. I understand that. I mean, you should read, you should understand. I mean, we're given opportunities to take it to attorneys or whomever, granted it should be attorneys, to find out the understanding of what we are assigning. But in this case, whether he went to an attorney or not, yeah, I understand he could have brought some sort of declaratory relief at that point. But he also had to hope this project was going to go through. If you look at the history of this thing, he went and got a water availability certificate issued, saying that there is water. He took
that
steps.
That might work for the first one he signed, but he let the first one lapse, knew all the rules at that point. It jumped all through the hoops, and then he came back, and he was willing to sign another new contract.
Yeah, and he had, because he had money expended at that point, he would like this thing to still go through. This was his living. He would like to be able to develop these properties, because if he develops the properties, the connection happens, the funds get used for the purpose. I think the problem, though, is that we have a district that's put this condition in there, and ultimately he's coming in and saying, yeah, I would like to do this, but I'm not able to. Things beyond his power prevented him from being able to go forward, he should get his money back. Normally in these type of contracts, you're receiving some sort of benefit. I think that's what the problem is here, is when you look at the connection statutes of 5708, 5722, talks about that they're going to pay their burden for which they take a part in or for which they're taking from.
Well, there's two provisions of 5722.010 that I'd like you to address. One is that the contract shall contain such conditions as the district may require pursuant to the district's adopted policies and standards. That seems to be pretty broad language in terms of scope of authority granted, and that the district can require provision of sufficient security to the district to ensure completion of the extension and other performance under the contract. Why don't those two provisions read together give the district the authority to require non-refundable deposits to encourage completion of promises made?
Well, because I think what you're looking at is the conditions of promises made is whether there is work actually performed.
The problem. Why is that? The district does things just to decide the connection extension can be built. It reviews plans to determine whether they comply with the engineering requirements of the existing system, whether they satisfy state regulations, whether they are adequate to provide a sufficient water source not only to the people that your client intends to prevent water to, but also the people that may ultimately connect on the far side of that extension to also receive water from the water district. So the district, whether your client actually builds it or not, is devoting resources to deciding whether to go ahead with your client's project or not. That costs the taxpayers or, in this case, the users of the system money.
And I agree, and I think that you, if you look at the language of 4320, which is the duty to serve of a district, that gives the district the authority to say, if we don't have this water available, if we don't have the resources available, we're not going to let you connect. They do moratoriums or anything, they just don't have to let them because they're not meeting that.
They have to do something else. They have to adopt a 20-year plan about how they're going to provide anticipated users within their user district, and if they don't, they'll find the state allowing other people to intrude in their user district and lose their monopoly.
Yeah, but that's exactly the point here. You're talking about a monopoly a district has here, which is the problem with the agreement to begin with. But I don't think that the state's going to come in and say, you don't have the water available yet, so we're going to start taking and carving your out and giving it over to other districts.
You haven't represented any water districts, have you?
I have, actually.
You've never encountered that with a small water district in some of our rural counties?
I've heard of districts doing it, and I've seen it happen. There's a district that's right next door to Covington Water District that's constantly being approached by other districts or threatened by other districts to take portions of theirs. But there is a lot of extra conditions that are going to come into something like that where you're trying to take from a district. It's not that simple. It's not simply, oh, you're not doing it. We're not providing this land, we're going to come take it away and give it over to this district over here because they can. Now, the district can take steps saying we don't have the resources, the funds, or whatever. Like, for example, in this situation, the water was not to my client's property. So as a part of the condition, my client was going to have to take that pipe all the way over to his property at his own cost. In the meantime, he's upgrading a number of properties that run along that same pipeline that he...
Water districts protect extension constructors with latecomers agreements that allows the recovery of some of the cost if other people connect within a certain period.
Yeah.
So that isn't something that's left unaddressed by water districts.
Yeah. I think they do have to make sure that there is something there for them, and if it's not, again, they have that authority to say, no, we're not going to provide this to you because we don't have the right to. You know, this property is a little bit unique. It's right in the almost in the middle of Covington Water District. So when you brought up the fact of another district coming in and offering, they would have to basically leapfrog into this little isolated portion within Covington Water District to be able to provide them. The cost, the reasonableness of all that is not what the courts are looking to do. The courts are the statutes are looking to do. The legislature have given these districts this exclusive monopoly control over this to try and make it more cost effective and make it more reasonable. But at the same time, you got to also allow the developers to come in. If he's not receiving a benefit, he has not burdened their system. So when you talk about
he has burdened the system. The day he walks in the door with an application, he burdens somebody in government with a review process.
But that was the district's choice to take on those expenses. They didn't. There's nothing requiring them to do that.
Well, would they take on those expenses if your client didn't walk in the door with an application?
That's true. They took them on already. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Eric Fremont, representing Covington Water District. I want to touch briefly on the facts of this case. You know, no doubt the developer picked a bad time to try to develop this property. Historic recession, you know, unfortunately he did fail. But the amounts of forfeiture or loss of incremental connection charges at issue in this case happened over a period of 5 years. And so the developer in this case did try to keep this project active. And, you know, and so a water... Well, in the sense that in most cases when development occurs, you have a water availability certificate and a system extension agreement that usually lasts about a year. And so in this case, it was over a period of 5 to 6 years where the developer kept on coming back and saying, I want an extension, where if Mr. Singh or the developer was not capable of proceeding with the project financially, they should have just waited until they were assured that they could move forward. And because of that, for every extension, they actually started paying more of the incremental connection charges, which resulted...
Does Mr. Singh's financial condition play any role in our analysis of whether this is within the powers of the water district?
I don't think it does. And so let me just move to the powers argument, which I think is it's clear from the statutes that the district has the power to include this kind of a term in their policy and their system extension agreements. So there's several sources of that power. One is 5708005, subparagraph 3, which gives water and sewer districts full power and authority to regulate and control the use of their system. So that
that's subject to the general laws.
Provided it is not contrary to general law, that's correct.
Should we look to contract law and see whether this kind of provision would be permitted between two private parties in deciding under the common law, in deciding whether or not this the right to have this kind of provision exists for water districts?
Yeah, I actually think that this is a private contract case. This is not an unlawful or illegal tax or penalty case. And so, when I call it
I see a lot of contract cases cited in any of the briefing by either party. You know, we have cases where people litigate non-refundable amounts in contracts, and I didn't see any of that case outside.
The appellant in this case chose to call this an unlawful tax case and relied upon the Samus case, which doesn't apply at all. And so I do think we are looking at a contract, which, in fact, in the record, the developer acknowledges is an enforceable contract. What they don't like is the fact that upon default that they lost the incremental payments that they had made over time. And the next significant statutory authority, Judge Alicia, you pointed that out, is in 5722010. There's two sub-provisions there that do allow the district to enter into contracts with developers. In fact, if a developer wants to develop within the district, you have to enter into a contract with them. And that you can, it's in order to ensure full compliance with the owner's obligation. And in this case, when any district makes a commitment to a developer, they've committed their water or sewer capacity. And when you enter into that contract, there's an incentive to get them going and to get that contract finished, because capacity is always an issue.
Does Covington charge a separate fee for review and approval for issuing the SCA or the proposed SCA?
They actually have what's called a developer review account. So I
understand there's that account, but I don't know. I couldn't tell from the record whether that money in that account comes from these extension fees that are levied per lot, or if there is a separate fee that is charged when you bring in your proposed project and the district does all of that review process and determines you can go ahead and proposes an SCA to the project developer.
Your Honor, I believe it is a separate $5,000 charge, and that may not be in the record, but it is a separate account, and that was one of the accounts that got refunded because the district does charge for its review time.
Charges for all of that, what economic harm comes to the district when the developer breaches the extension agreement by not building the proposed project?
Well, the harm that the district would be concerned about in this case is that if these incremental connection charge payments are viewed as refundable, that source of funds then becomes unusable and you have to keep it there as a deposit, and that becomes particularly damaging in the case when you've got a development that doesn't get off the ground for a period of 5 years. So the district in this case has a lot of developers.
You're going to tell me that the district is harmed because it already spent the money and can't pay it back. But in terms of the district operations, project planning, and so forth, what economic harm is caused to the district by the
Well, in this case, we have a situation where the district actually incurred $1.3 million worth of off-site improvements that were...
I understand those were right. Built before the application was submitted in this case, or at least the commitment to building was made.
And that's pretty true for any development that goes on within any district, that you don't wait for a developer to come in and say, I want to develop this property. As part of the planning process, districts are looking at areas that are unserved or underserved, and are spending resources in order to get either new pipeline in the ground or increased capacity because
evaluating forfeiture provisions in contracts, we usually look to some degree to the measure of harm caused by the benefiting party by the breach of the party who's losing whatever is being lost, in this case, these deposits.
Your Honor, I think the concern I would have about that statement is that if the district did what the statute says and says, look, we're not going to take an incremental connection charge, but we're going to make you post a performance bond, and they don't perform and complete that project or perform their contract, the district would have the right to make a demand upon that bond, which means the surety is going to step in.
I agree that you could do that, but we don't have any comparison between the amounts charged for these extensions and the cost of the premium for that performance bond. I mean, if they were comparable, it would be really difficult for Mr. Singh to complain. If the amount that the district is receiving costs Mr. Singh 10 times what a bond premium would cost, we might be concerned.
Well, I would agree that there is not that kind of evidence in the record, but I also think that it would be true that the way that all bonds operate, Mr. Singh would have signed a personal guarantee, and his harm actually would have been worse in this circumstance. And so that kind of takes me back to kind of the unique situation of this case where the period of time
could have imposed something that would be more economically onerous on Mr. Singh than what you did. This is an okay way to do it.
Well, I'm just saying under the facts of this case, it resulted in a loss of incremental connection charges. But Mr. Singh did not have to keep this project alive, and he signed not one but two contracts, knowing what. And in fact, the record indicates he had never failed. He just didn't think that that was even a possibility.
Okay.
So,
would this be characterized as a contract of adhesion?
I don't think so. I know that they've argued that this is a monopoly by the district, but what is described as a monopoly is what the legislature has set up for any municipal government, particularly water sewer districts. You are given a service area, and the statute says that another district can't serve within that area without your permission. And what typically happens a lot on boundary situations, if one district is not able to provide water service, the developer or homeowner will come in and say, hey, I'd like to get service. You can't provide it. Will you consent to the other district? That happens, often, but certainly not in the middle of your district and not when you have facilities that are there ready to be served. And actually, I would argue that $1.3 million of infrastructure, it actually made the development that Mr. Singh wanted to pursue possible. So he got really what he had an opportunity to succeed, and unfortunately he didn't. And the record indicates he's not blaming the district for that. It was just, it was a bad timing for a lot of development operations at that time. So we would ask that the court would affirm the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The first thing I want to do, I do believe Samus is a very relevant case. When you look at the elements that are laid out in Samus, there's three elements that kind of put there, and they're kind of looking at these charges or these fees that are implemented by local government authorities against property. Samus is a district that came through and said, your property here, so we're available to your water, we're going to charge you. Okay, this is different because my guy did approach the district. I understand that part of it. But when you're looking at that, you got to kind of look at what the charge is ultimately used for. In this case, when you look at the statutes, when he connects, the connection.
Can you decide whether something's a tax or not based on how the government entity spends the money?
I think you can, in the Sam's case, does look at that.
Is there a case that says we just look to that rather than whether it was something that was imposed uniformly on properties as opposed to being some part of a negotiated transaction?
Well, I think the problem, though, is this isn't a negotiated contract. These are the terms. I mean, Respondent's counsel stated that, you know, they came in and said, you know, we're bound, they're bound to provide them service, but here are the conditions for what we're going to do to provide
them. There are some things that are subject to negotiation, what it is you're going to build, where it's going to be.
That's true.
How many people can connect to it.
I do agree. I think you are subject to some terms, but it's not like he can pick this property up and move it to a different district. He is stuck with what that district is. Where
he could build one house as opposed to 31 houses.
He could, and again, this is his living. He's using the funds for what he needs to try and make a living. He tried to use the biggest and best use of this property. And in the 5 years, whether it's relevant or not, it shows that he did everything in his power to try and make this happen because he knew that money was there. He didn't want to lose $74,000. So he tried, but unfortunately it didn't fall through. Now we talk about, well, why did he put the money forward if he couldn't go forward with the project? Well, he's also going to get funding from a third party, either through loans or whatever, and they may require some sort of proof that you have water available to develop this property. So I ask, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The next matter is